This is the one with the Doc and a Dalek.
And an old man in spandex.
And kids with guns.
Oh, and a museum. In space.
And a hilarious reenactment of The Edge of Discretion.
Because we all need to see that again.
It's called The Space Museum.
Here we go.
We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space.
Encountering Dalek, Stalinood, and the Cybertronic race.
Centaurans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales.
And the Doctor has a TARDIS, we're reviewing all his tales.
Who back when?
Reviewing all of who there is.
Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey. What other choice could there be than
who back when?
Who back when?
Hello, and welcome to the long-awaited episode 15 of Who Back When,
a Doctor Who podcast.
That's Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin.
And I'm the Flaphammer.
Yes, you are.
Once again, I am the Flaphammer. It's been a while.
Hey, Flapjack.
Yeah?
I'm really pleased that you're back.
Yeah, I'm really pleased to be back.
Can we hug it out?
Let's go for it.
Oh, man, that's Everyone can hear the dude hug shoulder pat
the
there.
Flapping. Yeah, and it's good to see you, and it's good to see, you know, our people.
Well, I mean, you'll get,
As you can probably tell, that little delay in recording podcasts has made me shit at recording podcasts.
That's not true. Dude, we haven't even started yet. You know? Spoiler alert.
Yeah. That and the fact I watched Space Museum, 6 weeks ago? could make me a little ropey.
I saw it a week ago, again, hint. So, yeah.
No, I gave myself, a refresher course in the Space Museum. Oh, every bit worth it, also.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually nice to come back on a good episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Which is fairly hit and miss, as we know. Yeah.
Okie dokie. How do you feel about maybe doing a bite-sized chunk of Who?
Oh, I think we're well overdue. Yeah.
And by the way, in your absence, still no jingle.
Well done for the hard work. Good to see you've been beavering away.
Oh, how dare you? I've been working my ass off. All right, so, do you want to start?
Yeah, I guess why not? So, first of all, the Doctor and the notorious BIV materialise on the planet Xeros, where they unfreeze and stumble around, discovering that A, they're on a museum planet, and B, that they're already exhibits in said museum.
It turns out they've jumped their own timeline somehow, and are essentially waiting for themselves to arrive on the planet, so that they can then Marty McFly their own future and not end up being embalmed exhibit pieces.
The people running the museum are the evil Morok. They've enslave the local Xeron population, and they're trying their damnedest to catch up with the relative present troop before they do themselves. That kind of makes sense.
It does, yeah.
If you watched it, it made sense.
Oh, yeah, totally. And the Xeron, meanwhile, the only specimens of whom are present on the planet are black-clad adolescents, are about to stage a revolution, and they're about to have the least likely of collaborators.
Well, by virtue of the fact they don't actually exist for half of this serial. Which... We'll come to that.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
It doesn't entirely make sense, but that doesn't take away from the episode at all.
No, it is thoroughly enjoyable. Yeah. In that very special way.
Which I think kind of brings us to our first point, and actually when I was doing my little review of the episodes, having not seen them for 6 weeks, it still doesn't make sense to me. So, we came out of the last episode, they're wearing 13th century clothing.
Yeah.
And at the start of this episode, the whole troop get frozen.
They got frozen
at the end of the last episode, and we cut to them in freeze frame.
Yeah.
And suddenly, they are wearing modern clothes.
Yeah, and not just that, their period clothing from before, from the Crusade, is now hanging neatly in the wardrobe. So one can only assume that they didn't immediately unfreeze. Someone came into the TARDIS, redressed them, and probably had their way with them in the meantime, and then left the TARDIS and allowed them to unfreeze. That is the only way.
Now, without spoiling it, they are going to have some time, possibly, to change clothes. But we do see that little time delay happen towards the end of the episode, and there's no...
No, this doesn't happen because they actually...
change of clothes.
Dude, it doesn't happen because they actually point it out. They're like, why are we wearing this? And I think the Doctor or Ian, one of the dudes, says to Vicky, go check the wardrobe because you'll probably see that our old clothes are in there. And she does, and they are. So clearly they've been rigged. There is no way... There's no way around it.
It's not a logical progression to rape, dude. It could be a lot of things.
Pretty sure. Okay, fine. So it is a little bit of a leap to say that they've been raped.
All right, I'm pretty sure. You play with their junk, though, right?
I'm pretty sure that in court, I swear to shit, very clearly you could get an argument saying that there is some level of sexual harassment going on. That would hold up. Anyway. Okay.
But the interesting thing is, at the end of all of this, the doctor notices that the clothes have been changed, yeah. But he's completely unconcerned about it.
Yeah, he gives an explanation and says, it's time and relativity.
Yeah.
Yeah, wait, hang on. Did I call that an explanation? No, that's what he calls it.
And then the next thing that happens is he asks Vicky to go and get a glass of water for
Wait. Another point about the clothes. I know we're spending a lot of time on the first, 15 seconds of this episode. But another point about the clothes is they say they're now back in their normal clothes.
Yeah.
Which they are, with the exception of Vicky, who's now suddenly wearing a white dress, which we have never seen before.
Because
she wore that weird, Flash Gordon onesie before.
But to be fair, it does look like something that could be in her regular rotation. It's just, it's normal clothing for her.
I suppose, but she's probably wearing Susan's old clothes.
She's a young girl. She has lots of outfits, styles.
Have they gone shopping? No, they haven't. And when in the rescue, when she got invited on board, she didn't go I'll come with you guys, but let me go back to the spaceship crashed on the whatever, the white sports onesie jogging outfit guy's planet and get a suitcase full of my clothes, including a white dress I'll be wearing for no reason whatsoever in a few
hours. The TARDIS has an infinite amount of clothes. Surely you know this. How does anybody change?
This is a weird argument that we're having right now. Can any of those clothes, that infinite number of clothes, are Susan's?
That's possible, actually.
Must be.
Good point.
Unless the doctor is this weird miniature crossdresser.
Although I'd say Susan's probably a size 12 and Vicky's probably an 8, so it wouldn't really work.
That is true.
Yeah.
I don't know if Susan's a 12.
No, maybe not a 12. 10. Maybe 10. Maybe we're looking at 10. 10 and 6. Possibly.
You know what? She's a perfect 10. All right, so...
Dude, it's getting pervy again.
2 minutes in. All right, so...
Anyway, the next thing that happens is Doctor asks Vicky to go and get some water. She goes and gets the water, but drops the glass.
Because she's a klutz.
Yeah.
But what happens to this glass of water, Flapjack?
She's a klutz who can somehow rework machinery she's never seen before. Yeah, but we'll come to that.
I have really missed you.
So she drops this glass of water, but then, magically, time reverses, and it comes back up into her hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This makes no sense.
Other than, the only explanation for this is, time's gone a bit wibbly-wobbly.
Yeah,
the coverall term.
Yeah, but, okay, why isn't time reversing for her? Because she experiences the time reversal of the glass into her hand in her regular timeline. Yeah, exactly. It's not like she rewinds and all of a sudden she doesn't even know that she dropped the glass.
This is the only instance of this happening. So, time doesn't go wibbly-wobbly again. It's as if there is one more instance.
The dust, as in... Well, spoiler alert. In a little bit, Ian's going to remark that they're not leaving any footprints in the dust. And then later on, we see during the montage and the end of episode one...
Yeah, but that bit makes sense in totality.
Yeah, but very possibly, inside the TARDIS, the glass is shattering.
Actually, we see that, don't we? We see the glass shatter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we do. It's just one instance in the middle of time changing that happens. Just that.
If I were Vicky, I would probably not even have gone for the glass of water. I would just have gone why am I wearing this dress? Who undressed me? Anyway. Alright, fuck it, whatever.
All the same, the doctor still is unconcerned.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
About the water?
Yeah, I would say... I don't think so. I would say Bi are unconcerned. In fact, Bi totally do not believe her. But, that's Bar and Ian if you're just tuning in, but the doctor, he's the only one who actually believes her. He's the one who goes, oh really, that's kind of interesting.
He believes her, but he's not that bothered by it.
Okay, yeah, oh, fine.
This was the only point I was trying to make. He does believe her, at least.
Okay.
Which is more than he'd have given Susan.
That is very true. Anyway, so they turn on the scanner, look out of the TARDIS, and they see on the scanner, a whole bunch of different spaceships from various eras and various parts of the universe.
Yeah. And then those immortal words, the Doctor says it's safe to go outside.
Yep.
For some reason.
This is only cool. He has also, at this point, deduced that it is a museum. By sheer virtue of them coming from different times, this must be a museum. Which I don't really reckon must be the case. It could be a junkyard.
Ian said it was a dumping ground. Yeah. He thought it was a dumping ground, which makes just, well, more sense.
A lot more sense than a museum.
Yeah.
By the way...
Yeah.
In New Who, we've had... I'm sure there are episodes in between as well, but I remember an episode of New Who with Matt Smith going to a space museum. It's not the same one, but they also go to... Quote, space museum.
Yeah, no, I do remember.
And they've got a defunct Dalek in there as well who plays chess or something. Like a mechanical Dalek just plays chess, and then something happens and it turns out
it really is a real Dalek, and the Dalek gets inside of his head. It's that one, isn't it? The Dalek gets inside of his head and makes him play chess with himself.
That's a Cyberman episode.
Is that Cyberman?
You're thinking of something in silver. What? Vengeance in Silver or something like
whatever.
That.
We're in 64, dude.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's 65 at this point.
Shit.
Yeah. Anyway.
Time flies. Literally, in a TARDIS.
Yeah. So, they exit the TARDIS. The planet is totally dead, it looks like, anyway. Mm-hmm. Everything is extinct, is what they say, but it's not cold, Ian points out. It is extinct, but not cold, the way he imagines locales of extinction to be, such as, quote, like the dark side of the moon. Is that a place where something got extinct? Was there life on the dark side of the moon that I didn't know about at some point?
Well, there was that thing a few years back. Do you remember? They thought they discovered ridges in the moon that kind of said that there might have been water at some point.
The moon?
Yeah, I thought so.
I don't know.
I thought they found ridges that they said could have been valleys at some point.
Oh, interesting.
May have been water.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think it was ever proven.
I feel like that's more Martian in a way.
That could be. I might be.
This is a very weird sound.
This is the same guy as discussed when we started recording. I thought Prada, like as in the brand Prada, was spelled Pravda, which it turned out was the Bolshevik newspaper. And somehow I'd got those two pieces of information completely intertwined.
I think that's a perfectly natural mistake.
Whatever.
Anyway, we are coming up to our first soundbite of the episode. 7.5 minutes into episode one, we get a reveal sound effect. They're walking around. They exit the TARDIS. They're walking around. And Ian points out that they're walking on dust several inches thick. And he says, then why aren't we leaving any footprints? At which point we get... Soundbite?
Soundbite.
Soundbite. Fantastic. What a soundbite. And we get some great miniatures. The rockets and the building in particular, when they zoom into that door, it looks like very nicely done. Yeah.
So the next thing that happens. So Ian and Barb find a building that has locked doors, right?
They approach the building that we zoomed in on.
Yeah, and Barb notices, again, something really odd. There's no echo in the building at all.
But hang on, they're still outside the building.
This still plays into the whole theory. Oh, sorry, I've moved in.
Okay, wait, hang on. Because there is something very important that happens before they enter. While they're standing outside the building, I've only pointed out here in my notes, Vicky looks preposterous in her dress. Then the doors open, and they stand around, like, long enough for anyone to see them by the open doors, while we see two white guys in Raelian outfits approach, and then the troop, like, jump around the corner and hide, Vord style, and the white-clad dudes just walk past them. They don't see them.
Yes, sorry.
This is the first instance of an important plot point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, like, the first instance of no one seeing them in this the storyline. Oh, yeah, and Vicky is about to sneeze.
Yes. And then she does sneeze.
She does sneeze, but how fucking dumb is it? She's about to sneeze and Barb literally puts a finger under her nose like she's a stupid cartoon, which prevents her from sneezing for a moment, and then she does sneeze.
How would you stop her sneezing?
I don't know, like cover her entire nose and mouth so that when she does sneeze, it blows her brain out of her ears. Anyway.
Well, I've suppressed many a sneeze in my time. And
It hurts.
It does hurt.
But did you ever suppress those sneezes by literally just putting a finger symbolically like a fake mustache under your nose?
No, I didn't. It's got to be said. She does an abnormally large sneeze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the white-clad dudes, the aliens, they do not hear it. They just walk on.
Yeah, which, again, is very strange. And the fact that there's no echo.
There's no echo, and...
I presume the sneeze didn't echo.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So then they find a Dalek.
Vicky's heard them in history books, but think they look quite friendly, and we get a funny little moment.
Yeah, exactly. And she remembers, she says she read about them having taken over the Earth at one point, and Ian just goes, like, we were there when it happened. Nostalgically, in a way.
Is she, like, bullshit to that?
I can't remember.
No, I can't remember.
I can't remember at all. But
she seems quite dismissive of the fact that these are the most terrifying creatures in the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But then we meet the other group that inhabit this planet.
Yeah.
These young, crazy-eyebrowed young young guys walk past. I had them down as guards, but obviously they're not guards.
No, they're wearing black.
Rebels. They're wearing black. Mm. Just in case this episode was getting too complicated for people, yes, okay, so we're going to have a group all in white and a group all in black. But then,
no shades of grey.
We're going to reverse it. The white guy's the bad guy.
Yeah, no. So the black dudes, black clad dudes, I should say, they walk in, and the troop Vord style hide behind the Dalek, or behind like an exhibit piece. And not just are they not spotted by the kids are speaking. We clearly see them speaking, but we can't hear them.
So this is interesting. So if you get jumped forward in time, which, spoiler alert, is what happened to the troop.
Yeah.
You can see everything, but you can't hear anything. Why?
Well, I think we're going to have to try to explain the logic of this at the end of episode
audio
one.
Delay? I really don't get it.
Well, we do get kind of an explanation of it at the end of this episode, so let's not jump ahead. But there are so many things in this serial that make very little sense. Okay. I feel like a broken record, but maybe we should spend more time on the clothing, because this is so freaking weird. Anyway, all right, let's not. Next up, Vicky, against the instructions of the Doctor, tries to touch one of the exhibit pieces and finds that it's essentially a hologram. Like, or it has the effect of it being a hologram. Her hand just goes right through it.
Yeah. And three more guards walk past, and they're absolutely silent, even though they're speaking.
I think they're dudes in black, actually.
Oh, I thought they were white. Never mind.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And the Doctor starts to wonder whether they're really there at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is actually really interesting.
Yeah, that's really
interesting. At this point, we're like going,
oh, my interest is peaked.
Yeah. This is an interesting, well-thought-out serial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, little do we know at this point that it's not.
Little do we know. And then even more interestingly, the next exhibit they stumble upon is actually the TARDIS.
Yeah.
This is getting more fucked up by the minute.
Yeah, I've got another line for you. This isn't a soundbite. I'm just going to quote it and then disparage it completely.
I've got one from the Doctor.
Oh, I've got one from Barbara.
Oh, God.
Do you want to go first? Or
well, no, my one refers back a little bit. When Vicky first starts touching the exhibits, the Doctor says, when are you going to learn to obey me?
Oh, nice! Oh, this is fantastic. Okay, so anyway, maybe we should theorise. I'm guessing the Doctor actually unfroze in time before the rest, felt up Vicky a little bit, changed her clothes, played around with her like she was a doll.
And that's why
he pretended to unfreeze with the rest.
And that's why he's so cool when he's finding out all this stuff's happening. He's like,
He's actually spent like a year there. Just like, oh yeah, so much
just
fun.
Just fiddling. Anyway, see a hologramic TARDIS.
And the line that I've got here is from it, well, actually, it's more like they're holograms rather than everything else being a hologram, right? Because they're not really there. But
yeah, they're not actually holograms. They're just holograms to them.
Yeah, they're like parallel to our dimension or whatever. But the line that I had was from Barb, who says, and I quote, "Now that we've found the TARDIS, we should get the shit out of Dodge Gringos." Here's the thing, though. They weren't looking for it.
No. Yeah. They've come from it.
They hadn't lost it.
No.
Like, for all they know, the TARDIS is outside.
Yeah, where they left it.
Where they left it. So
purposefully.
Yeah. They deliberately exited the TARDIS and entered a separate building. Then they stumble upon the TARDIS, and she treats it as though they lost it, and now finally, after years of searching, they found it, and now they need to get the shit out of Dodge.
Yeah.
Makes no sense. God, continuity. Anyway, the Doc wants to stay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So after they see the TARDIS, the next thing they see is exhibits of themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This
inside glass casing.
Yeah, I don't know how we're gonna call this trope, but it is basically the same trope as the huge F-off pyramid on the Web Planet, or the massive shard lookalike on Marinus. Because they are standing right next to the exhibit of themselves.
Yeah.
They're talking about, like, oh, that's the TARDIS that we didn't lose. And then, all of a sudden, they notice that right next to them is an exact duplicate of all of them. And they just go, holy shit, that's right there.
There's no wall in between. It's literally just standing there.
Yeah,
and rightly, you'd think if there were, even if it wasn't them, even if it was just any people inside glass casing, they would have noticed that first up, right?
Yeah, you would think so. So now we have the explanation of it. Do you want to do the explanation of what's going on?
Well, kind of. So Vicky actually is the first one to say, I think we're working across multiple dimensions here. Yeah. That's the only possible explanation. And then the Doctor gives a full explanation.
Yeah, he says the TARDIS jumped a time track. And basically what he says is that they've come unstuck in time, to quote Vonnegut. And now they're peering into the future.
Into a possible future.
Into a possible future. And they basically just need to wait for themselves to arrive. And there are two lines that the Doctor delivers that are ridiculous.
Yeah.
Line number one, he says to Vicky, I think, I've always found it extremely difficult to solve the fourth dimension.
Okay.
The fourth dimension is time. He is a time traveller.
He's a time lord.
He's a time lord.
He has an MSc in time. And he's always found it difficult.
Yeah. So that's the first bonkers line. And the second line, which I almost feel that we should soundbite, is...
So, if... Could be in a few moments or a few seconds.
That's a pretty constricted interval, Doc.
Well, how long's a moment?
Less than a few seconds, apparently.
Well, I guess a moment, you could say it'd be like, 10 seconds max?
So how much is a few? A few to me is 3 or 4.
A few is 3 or 4, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe 30 seconds.
So it could be between 3 or 4 seconds.
Like three to 30.
Oh, he's one of those really annoying people who go, I'll be there between 7 and 6.
Yeah.
I hate people who do that. Anyway, so that's it. And that's like the finale of episode 1, more or less. On its most fundamental level, this is Back to the Future 3.
And I think this is when we see the little the little vignette of the glass breaking inside.
Yeah, there's like a montage.
Yeah, and so it's like, boom, TARDIS arrives, glass breaks.
Yeah. The
Doctor's explanation is absolutely correct. They've arrived.
Yeah, I made a little bullet point list of the things included in the montage. Fantastic, with like super suspenseful music.
And the most interesting part of this, and we'll come on to this later, what happened here? Like, it's a... There must have been a huge... Yeah. Like, how the hell did this happen? Like, this has got to be, like... Time and space has imploded, right?
Well, it's okay. You're going to get a very,
very... We will get a very, very satisfying explanation.
Yeah, and thorough.
Yeah.
So, the finale is the music.
Finale.
The white guys appearing by the TARDIS, as in the white-clad guys appearing by the TARDIS, still shots of the troop in different clothes, the exhibit vanishing McFly style, and then the Doctor saying, we've arrived.
Mm.
End of episode 1. Muy fantastic.
Boom. Episode 2, which is called...
The Dimensions of Time. Even though you might argue that time in itself is a dimension, by the way.
It is. It's the fourth dimension, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that the Doctor doesn't get. Maybe he wrote the title of the series in this episode.
So, we start off on episode 2 with a bit of confusion. My mind is already blown. So the first thing we see is two guys clad in white.
Yeah, the Moroks.
Yeah, they're chatting. So we find out a little bit about them. So they're talking about the alien visitors and how they could be added to the museum. So we get a sense that these Modoks are the bad guys.
Moroks.
Oh, sorry.
Let's just call them morons.
The
morons. Yeah, they are moron number one,
what is
Lobos.
That is something. Oh,
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Moron number one, Lobos, is the governor of this planet, and he volunteered for the service and has another 2,000 Xeron days to go. And Moron number two, however, was ordered. I'm going to want to put a pin in this because we now know for a fact that most of the morons are not there, like, voluntarily.
They've been conscripted.
They've been drafted. Yeah, exactly.
And
in fact,
we get a little reference later in the episode where the governor is saying, you know, you're meant to be trained troops, not a bunch of amateurs, which they are, essentially.
Which they are,
they're conscripts.
Most of them are middle-aged and slightly overweight.
Yeah. So we postulated, what was it, 37?
37,
the age of conscription in Morok. Yeah.
So then Moron number three arrives and tells of the arrival of aliens, who are the troop. And we also learn that there are rebels about the planet who might try to contact these aliens.
Yeah.
Cut to the rebels.
Cut to the rebels. And they're talking about how they can use these aliens to try and fight the Morok.
Yeah.
So battle lines have been set up firmly at the start of episode 2.
Yeah. They're kids. They are actual kids. The three...
Like, yeah, like 16, 17.
Yeah, the three kids that we meet, they are Tor, Deko, and Sita.
And they all have the most wonderful eyebrows in the world.
Fantastic eyebrows. And Zeta, I think it is, has a gap between his front teeth big enough to park a Fiat in.
The guys in white don't have crazy eyebrows, right?
They've got crazy hair.
Right.
They've got like a weird Leningrad Cowboys type haircut that stretches down onto their foreheads in a spike.
Okay, cool.
I think. Anyway, cut to the notorious BIV stealing a rifle from an exhibit because there are no alarms in this museum.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We have a very interesting conversation. The doc starts getting worried about changing the future, right? There is a bit before that.
Oh, well, there's really not much to say about the buttons. Barbara suddenly notices that one of Ian's buttons, as in jacket buttons, is missing. And we get a tiny little discussion in which it's just a bit of fluff. Because the doctor says, oh, it's a shame you didn't notice if the button was missing from the exhibit version of you.
Yeah, which didn't have to be fluff. That could have been used to wind up the story and explain the
But it ends up being fluff because this is of no importance to the story.
And if we'd been less lazy, we'd have actually gone back and seen whether he was missing a button or not.
Yeah.
Which would be sort of quite an interesting discussion point. But fuck it.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
We do have an interesting discussion where the doctor's talking about, he's worried about changing the future, you know, the first law of time travel.
Prime directive.
But this is why the Doctor is adamant they cannot leave. Because at this point, it's a good question. Well, why don't they try and get back outside to the TARDIS?
Oh, yeah, that's true. And he says something like, yeah, but how? That's not going to help us. Like, it's very possible that we'll travel around for a bit and then we'll end up being exhibit
and
pieces.
Yeah, also says it's inevitable we're going to end up back in there.
Yeah, so now we absolutely need to change our future.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which
is, you might argue that them leaving the planet could be them changing the future.
Well, exactly.
But just stay away from this planet. The only thing they could do to absolutely ensure this would be to blow up the museum.
Exactly. Which is it? Is it inevitable or is it changeable? It's got to be one of the two. And if you don't know what the future's going to hold, surely any action you take could potentially be leading you to your destiny.
Yeah.
So the choice to stay could be the choice that leads him inside the glass.
And I hate to say it, but like, it seems like it would be more likely to happen if they stick around.
Yeah. But anyway, that's the Doctor's reasoning for not just going straight back to the TARDIS. Because at this point, the whole troop are together. They haven't been spotted yet. Ian's got a gun.
Yeah.
He could just get outside.
That's true.
And we'd have been spared the next 50 minutes. I say spared, it was a great romp.
I actually really enjoyed this. But then some of the rebel kids arrive.
Yeah.
Vought sneaking around in Converse, and which, by the way, they are totally freaking wearing. Either way, the troop, for some reason, kind of gets separated for a little bit because the doctor stays back and investigates, like, he checks out one of the contraptions there.
Yeah.
And then the rebel kids, they just nab him, knock him out, or mm-hmm. so they think. And two of them, the leader, Tor, and Sita, the guy with the massive gap between his teeth, they leave to fetch some smelling salts. And Dako, Donnie Dako, I've got him down as, he stays with the doc.
Yeah, but they also see Ian and Barb, right? And they're very pleased to see that Ian has a gun. That was what they were hoping for.
They have a bit of
discussion, but they don't know whether he's friendly or not.
Yeah.
And the fact that they knocked out his friend may turn him slightly angry.
That's a good point. But we do cut to Bai.
Before that, though, should mention that we also get a discussion with the Moroks, who have found the troop's footsteps, so they know the troop are around and they're looking for them.
Oh, yeah,
so
good
again,
point.
Battle lines have been set up.
Yeah. So now we know that they're after them.
Yeah. So the rebels have got the doctor knocked out, but they're being nice to him. They're looking for smelling salts.
Yeah, exactly. And now we cut to Bai having a super loud and indiscreet argument about the doctor's whereabouts. And Vicky says he's probably been captured, and Bai go full on doctor on her ass. Just basically telling her that she is useless, she's a little girl, and her opinions matter absolutely not.
Yeah, Ian's basically just pissed off with the doctor for wandering off.
Yeah.
And being a wanderer.
That's true, but now they have decided to go and find him, and Vicky leads the way for no reason whatsoever, holding the rifle badly. As in, her finger isn't even on the trigger, she's just sort of holding the rifle, and she leads the way. Why isn't Ian, who is probably a veteran, right?
He's got to be.
At the very least, he's a veteran science teacher. Why is he not? And he's the man in 1965. He should be wielding the gun.
Yeah, given what happens in episode 3, like, he really should be.
He goes...
This is a return to badass Ian.
Oh, yeah. He goes Walker Texas Ranger on everyone.
This is almost Aztec level badass.
This is thanks to his Aztec training, I think.
We'll get We'll get there.
Yeah, so then cut back to, what's his face again? Tor and Sita, returning to, they think, the Doctor and Donnie Darko.
But
instead they just find Donnie neatly bound and gagged.
Where did he get the rope? But the Doctor's missing, and it emerges that he's actually hidden inside of the Dalek.
Yeah.
Which is that's a really good idea, actually, because the first time we saw the Daleks, that was the escape technique. So the Doctor knows there's enough space for him inside.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, it was Ian who got in last time, got into inside the Dalek.
Yeah, that's true. So now's the Doctor's turn.
Now's the Doctor's turn.
I've got a screenshot of that on the website, and we need to have a soundbite of this, because the Doctor impersonates a Dalek. And it's hilarious.
For no one's benefit. Right?
No,
for fun.
Yeah. And when his head bobs out of the Dalek, you can tell that he is enjoying himself. Like, this is the first time since 1963 that he is having a genuinely good time recording one of these shit stories. Anyway, soundbites?
Soundbites.
Soundbites.
I told them all. I am the master.
But the Doctor's joy or glee is short-lived. It's like the second he gets out of the Dalek, pretty much. He walks out of the door and bam.
Immediately
straight into the Morrocks.
Yeah.
Which is really bad news, because the Doctor starts getting interviewed by the Governor.
Yeah, but tiny bit of trivia. One of the moron guards here is played by Ken Norris. No reason whatsoever you should have heard of him, but he played Colonel Toro in Octopussy.
Oh.
Yeah. He's the guy that looks very much like Roger Moore in the very beginning, so that Roger Moore can just put on a fake mustache and impersonate him.
Nice.
Yeah.
No.
Then cut back to Ian, who's having a brainwave about Theseus.
Yeah. And he's just like, oh, Minotaur.
Theseus, where?
Yeah, it's a museum, right? They could actually have a Minotaur, but no. He's actually just tearing up Barb's cardigan, which isn't as sexual as it sounds.
No, no.
to make a thread so that they can find their way back.
Yeah, but he is eating. He is chomping down on this cardigan. I reckon there's a level of jealousy as well, because up until a few serials ago, he was the cardi-wearing guy.
Mm.
And now all of a sudden, he's just wearing suits or whatever.
Sexual revolution, right?
Yeah. She's wearing a cardi, and he's like, fuck this shit. Starts eating it. Anyway, cut to the Doctor in a cell, and he gets future locked in a chair,
yeah,
and introduced
to
Lobos.
This is great. So the Lobos's interviewing technique is essentially to hook the Doctor up to a lie detector with pictures. And we get a little insight into what's actually going on inside the Doctor's brain.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, the implication is he's very powerful, he can switch his mind to think about anything, but the first thing he thinks of is an old man in spandex.
Yeah, it looks like...
looks like him.
It does look like him wearing spandex and a hat, a bowler hat.
Yeah.
At a professional photo shoot.
Mm.
So very clearly, this is like a moment from his past when he was young, dumb, and in need of money. And he just had to appear in a photo shoot in some weird Time Lord pornography magazine.
It kind of looks like he's in that Kubrick film, Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You get a little bit of Clockwork flashbacks there.
The next thing that comes up on the scanner is a group of walruses.
Right? Walruses. Actually, that's not the first one. The first thing he shows is a penny farthing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How did you get here? Penny farthing. What is your sexual inclination? Spandex geriatric gentleman in a bowler hat.
What is your pastime? Banging walruses, apparently.
And it almost actually goes like, wait, what are these creatures? They look amphibian. You are not amphibian. It's pretty cool.
I think it's basically just meant to show the Doctor's got a very powerful brain. He can turn his attention to anything, be it men in spandex or walruses.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to give anything up.
Yeah. There is, however, an actual moment where, before he realises what's going on, quote unquote, so we think anyway, because very clearly this is like a Gruber and McLean situation, where Lobos asks him, where are your companions? And we see an image of VIB, or BIB, in a particular part of the museum, and Lobos goes, oh right, that's where they are. He calls the guards to go there.
Mm.
This is very much like McLean and Gruber, but Gruber posing as Bill Clay. When he's giving, like, fake information, he gives Gruber the gun, and it's like, blah, 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 blah. We think that he's fallen for it, but in fact he hasn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, because we do find out
great
that...
Great scene, by the way.
Such a good scene. What's your name? Clay. Bill Clay.
Bill Clay. Oh my God, they're shooting everywhere!
Like, jeez, Dame Fenster. Grammatically incorrect, by the way. He's meant to be German.
Great performance, though.
Fantastic performance.
Englishman doing a German, doing an American. Brilliant.
Oh, great. Yeah. He's very good. But yeah, so...
That's pretty much the end of the episode, dude.
So... Well, almost. We cut back to BIV. They've run out of string. And Bob says, maybe the doc's wrong and you can't change the future. And at this point, my note actually says, it just occurred to me that this whole story is predicated on the notion that you can.
Because otherwise, why would they bother doing anything?
Exactly.
They're inevitably going to end up as wax.
But how many times up until serial number 15 have we been told you cannot change the future?
Yeah.
And now it's taken for granted. Even though, okay,
we have seen futures change.
Yeah, we have.
In fact, he calls
Nero
the,
and
burning of Rome.
But we have been told it is sort of taken for granted that you cannot change the future.
Well, and also, so Rome was always going to burn. In the Nero example, Rome was always going to burn, and the Doctor's actions led to the burning of Rome.
Yeah, but very possibly it would have burned anyway.
Yeah, but therefore the Doctor coming back was inevitable to cause the burning of Rome.
Yeah, exactly. It's all like relativity or whatever. But the
wibbly wobbly, yeah.
Wibbly wobbly. But so now they can. Anyway, either way, it's like taken for granted you can totally change the future if you want to.
But
so
the Doctor's fucked, pretty much. He's tied up, and he's going to be taken away for preparation.
Yeah, exactly. After we see the German spandex porn from the First Great War. So we cut back to VIB. They rush off as Ian discovers something. Lobos is about to mannequin the Doc, and that's it. Blam. Cliffhanger.
Bam, cliffhanger. Episode 3, The Search.
The Search. It turns out the thing that Ian found was the TARDIS.
Mm-hmm.
Alas, the Morrocks found it first, and it's being guarded by morons while black-clad youths admire it up close.
Yeah.
This is very, very strange to me. So, the black-clad youths, they are the rebels.
Mm-hmm.
Or some of them are rebels. Not all kids are bad kids, right? But, like, some kids are...
They're not bad at all, but...
No. But, like, as far as the morons are concerned...
No, well, it makes sense, because the morons' conscription age is 37. So, anybody below the age of 37 is therefore a rebel. And we do find out why they're all so young, as well.
Well, like, there are adults. There are Xerox copying machine adults, but they've been taken to other planets to be enslaved.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas the youths are the adolescents. So they still remain on the planet, and some of these adolescents, they want to stage a coup. They are rebels.
Yeah.
But why would you just leave them there? Like, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, that doesn't make any
sense.
You
wouldn't let them walk around freely if you've taken over the planet and you plan on having everyone be slaves.
It's the first rule of war. Like, always kill the firstborn child. Well, no, seriously, that's what the Romans did. They killed young boys. They used to throw babies off the roof and they'd enslave the women.
Yeah, because otherwise they're going to grow up to...
Exactly.
Yeah. But either they would enslave these kids because they're clearly old enough to pick up rocks and whatever. They're old enough to wield guns. But either way, they wouldn't let them walk around.
No. And in fact, they let...
They do, because they're like there admiring the TARDIS while it's being guarded by morons.
Hmm.
It's really
but
weird.
But do the morons see?
Yeah. They're right there.
But are they actually allowing their existence?
Do they
not? They do.
Totally. And this is mind-boggling. This is flummoxing to me because if you knew that when you reach a certain age, instead of being allowed to vote or drive a car, you're going to be enslaved and sent to a different planet, you would probably do something about it before you reached that age, right?
Yeah, quite true.
But not on the planet Xerox copying machine, because here they just let them walk around freely. Doesn't matter. Whatever.
Doesn't matter.
So,
okay.
Moron number one.
Yeah, Moron number one wants to find the other three. So they've got the Doctor, and they need to find the other three. And almost immediately, one of the morons stumbles upon VIB.
Yeah, but there isn't...
No, they do. They stumble upon VIB talking. Yeah,
but while the VIB are looking at the TARDIS, there's a different moron. Sorry, that's entirely my mistake. It's not moron number one.
No,
it's I've got them down as Peugeot.
So there are the morons who are standing in front of the TARDIS.
Yeah, and one of them, who's like the sub-leader...
are watching them through a crack in the door.
Exactly, right? And the guy who's like the troop leader over there, that moron, I've got him down as Peugeot, because he looks like a human Peugeot. He complains about being the constant scapegoat.
Yeah.
I think he is actually moron number two from before.
Okay, right.
And then Lobos arrives and says, the Doc's captured. That's where we get this. But we have this tiny little cutscene of moron god Peugeot basically going, Lobos is a douchebag and I hate working for him.
Yeah. But he's a conscript, so he's going to think that, right?
Yeah, okay, that's true.
He doesn't want to be there.
Yeah. So now, blah, 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 you're totally right. Now,
more importantly...
Yeah, sorry, sorry.
B.I.B. gets spotted by a bunch of morons, and there is a very interesting leap of logic on Ian's part. So they start chatting just at gunpoint while they're being held by the morons.
Yeah, and Ian's like, almost uninterrupted two-minute conversation.
Yeah, hey, hang on. We can't be killed because it's inevitable. We're going to end up in the cases. But that's sort of like two different schools of logic. Yeah. Ian's like, actually, I can do whatever I want because they're not going to kill me because I'm going to end up in that case. And therefore, I can
change my future. Is that something he tells BV?
Yeah, he's talking to BV about it.
Ah.
Yeah.
But then, anyway, so then
so he's like, I'm just going to do what I like. Fuck
yeah, and
it.
He starts NLPing the moron.
Yeah.
By the way, Vicky has at this point just handed over the gun to the moron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but the gun is of no consequence.
Because Vicky's wielding it.
Yeah.
That's the only reason the gun is unimportant. If Ian had held the gun, or the rifle, he could have just shot the moron in the face. Problem solved. But instead they gave it to a fucking girl who then just hands it over, poorly, to a moron, so that they can chat uninterruptedly for 2 fucking minutes!
But Eon's line of argument is basically that he tells the Morok, your superiors will be very upset if you shoot me, I'm meant to be inside the wax casing or whatever.
Yes, sorry. Which, I had totally forgotten about that.
Yeah, so he, at that point, like, he's completely fucked him over with logic, although it's not all that logical.
No, he just kind of NLPs him a little bit.
But then he manhandles him. Like, he uses his brute force.
Oh, shit, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
How long is this scene, by the way?
He's set upon by about, I think it's about 8 Moroks.
This is where the Aztec fighting training came into
play. But they drag him outside, so there's only 3 Moroks on him. I don't know what happened to the other 5, but they drag him outside, and Ian beats the crap out of them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, he kung-fus them. It's fucking great.
It is, and it's really, it is badass.
Yeah.
And everyone gets separated. This is the splitting up trope, because he's fighting morons, Barbara runs away, hides in a closet, or a cupboard or whatever, and Vicky runs off and is about to meet up with the kids.
But it is a departure from the usual splitting up trope. They haven't decided to split up. They've been split up this
That's
time.
True, but why don't BV, why don't they run off together? Why do they get separated? Because Barbara just jumps into a cupboard.
Yeah. Every man for himself at that point.
Right? Okay, sure.
But so the rebels capture Vicky. It's not actually the Moroks.
Yeah, it's the kids.
Yeah, and they explain to her that they are in fact enemies of the Moroks and that they're good people who inhabit the planet and they're just looking to live, basically. Yeah.
This is not the frat house gangbang we've come to expect at the point.
And also they, you know, despite the fact that they beat up the Doctor, which is fine apparently, they didn't hand him over to the Moroks.
Yeah.
It was the Doctor escaped and got himself entangled.
True.
Snared.
Cut back to Ian, who's Vord lurking behind the TARDIS.
He's running the show.
Yeah, but it makes very little sense, because he just beat 3 moron guards to a pulp.
Yeah.
Didn't take
any of their guns.
Exactly, there are thus 3 laser beam weapons on the floor.
Yeah, but he's Ian, he doesn't need to.
Yeah, but wait, hang on.
Ian can get a gun anytime he likes.
Okay, that is true, but it's so weird, because he doesn't pick up a gun, and he doesn't run away.
Uh-huh.
Instead, he hides behind the TARDIS, waits for the 3 morons to, like, regain consciousness, and then
hiding in plain sight.
And then, when only one guard is posted by the TARDIS again, Ian pops out from around the corner and steals his gun, holds him at gunpoint, and it looks very badass. Screenshot on the website, by the way.
Yeah, and his reason for doing this, he does need to beat up another guard, because he's knocked the other 3 out, you see.
Oh, yeah.
He needs to find out what happened to the Doctor.
That's true.
So he, like, holds this guy at gunpoint and, like, finds out.
Mm.
The Doctor's been taken away to a preparation room, and time is of the essence.
Yeah, exactly.
Point. Yeah,
exactly.
And demands to be taken to the Doctor, but the guy obviously can't. He's too low level or something.
Yeah, but doesn't he say something like, okay, so next time someone comes up, I need you to find out where the Doctor is or something to that effect.
Something to that effect.
Yeah. So then, meanwhile, Lobos has received a communique from the planet Moron saying that they need to kill all of the Xeron youths.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which, why this is only happening at this point?
Exactly.
Buck only knows.
Yeah, this is the flaw in their logical reasoning that we pointed out a moment ago.
But essentially, they decide to start gassing the whole place. Mm. And it's, things are getting rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty bad. They're going to use paralyzing Zafra gas.
Sounds bad, right?
It sounds very, very bad. So then, blam, 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 the Xeron kid, Donnie Darko, he finds Bob,
mm-hmm.
and...
She tries to kill him with a crowbar, but they get chatting.
Yeah, because he knows her name, so she mm-hmm. realises, oh, he must have spoken to one of my compadres.
Yeah, and he explains again that they've been invaded.
Yeah, a few years ago, they had superior weapons, yada, 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 and then the gas arrives.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Donnie is telling Bob about the whole invasion thing.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, he's still telling her the story. Coincidentally, we cut to Vicky being told the second half of the story.
Yeah.
From exactly that point.
Yeah.
By Tor and whatever. And they're sitting in, like, what looks like a subterranean pub, because they're drinking, or like a Starbucks or something, but they're drinking
I was going to say, it looks kind of pleasant.
Actually. It looks like Guinness.
Yeah.
It looks like they're having pints of Guinness. Anyway.
We are in black and white, so most things look like Guinness, to be fair.
I think there's a screenshot on the website as well.
It could be dark ale. Yeah. But anyway, so cut back to Vicky. Yeah, she's being told the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And they're now trying to devise a plan about how they're going to take over.
Yeah, for some reason, she is now Che Guevara.
Again, they've never thought of this before. Like, they're just like, oh, we really hate them. Like, should really do something, but fuck it, what are you going to do? Vicky turns up, and she's like, I shall lead you. And actually, they do really need her technical expertise.
Yeah, well...
They wouldn't have been able to do it without her.
That's true. The one thing that their potential revolution is missing is armaments.
Yeah.
And it turns out the armory is safeguarded by this artificial intelligence lie detector.
Yeah.
And you have to tell it... You have to answer...
It's like the end of the Holy Grail.
It is, exactly. Oh my god, that is so true. Yeah.
What's your favourite colour?
I was going to say, the weird guy guarding the bridge in Holy Grail.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Vicky now says, okay, let's go to this place, because I want to take a crack at this machine. So weird. But, oh...
Yeah, so technology she's never seen before, and she's never been to this planet, never even heard of these people, but she has total confidence that she will be able to break this machine.
Yeah, so then, just want to read out what I've written here, because this came straight from the heart when I was watching this scene. Cut to a lazy, yawning, 1 week from retirement, too old for this shit security guard, with 6 kids, a loving wife, and who may have been drafted against his will in the first place, guarding the lie detector that in itself is a security measurement, having the proverbial shit beaten out of him by ruthless Nazi brats, aka the Xerons.
Yeah, I actually did think the first time I saw these rebels, Edelweiss Pirates, they pretty much are. Edelweiss Pirates are a good group. Like, they're a solid group.
So anyway. Then, yeah, Vicky sets about hacking the contraption.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a cutscene of Babs collapsing, and then we see Vicky having hacked it.
Yeah. Is that the next thing that happens? Don't we get a cutscene with Ian? So he's telling the Morok to pretend to his leader that all is well. And
oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So this is Ian's in to try and find the Doctor.
Yeah, he gets that the guy he had at gunpoint before yeah. to just ask a few questions.
Yeah, and that's how he gets more information. That's how he manages to get to the control room.
Yeah, which happens in a little moment.
Yeah.
But first, we get the Vicky hacking scene. Mm-hmm. Go for it, dude. Take it away.
Well, there's not a lot to say other than she gets in there, sticks her head under the bonnet, and
yeah.
all of a sudden... So she's not able to completely disable the machine, but she's able to change the functions on it so that you only need to tell the truth. You don't need to...
Like, specific truths.
Give specific yeah. answers, because they need things like rank of the person, name of the person.
Yeah, do you have like, the
special entrance code, yeah. governor's permission.
Have you got a signed form and whatever, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, and she manages to rig the machine so that it asks things like, I mean, I can't remember what it specifically was, but it was something like, what's your favourite colour?
Yeah, at the risk of stating the obvious, I kind of feel like Vicky's just too dumb to pull something off.
Well, yeah, obviously. But if she's able to fuck with the machine to that extent, why didn't she just disable it? Like, surely it's easier to shut it down than to get it to ask random questions. Like, why would it have something like, what's your favourite colour in its memory bank?
Well, that's not the question.
Yeah, like, I know.
Do you have permission? She goes, no. And then the doors open.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. So then, blam, 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 cut to the finale where Ian is entering Lobos's office. Mm-hmm. He's toting a gun and...
Wants to be taken to the doctor, obviously, and the governor's saying, it's too late.
Yeah, we have a fantastic Ian soundbite, by the way.
He's been embalmed.
Fantastic yeah. soundbite. Soundbite?
Soundbite.
Soundbite.
You'll be a fool if you kill me. You will achieve nothing.
Possibly, but it might be enjoyable.
It's a great life.
True that.
And then the cliffhanger is Ian looks, we assume, upon the Doctor. Well, we know upon the Doctor, who apparently has entered into the second stage of being turned into a mannequin.
Yeah.
But we don't see the Doctor yet. We can only fear the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And then, vroom.
Vroom.
End of episode 3.
The final? Of the final phase.
The final phase, episode 4.
Yeah, and yeah, when we see the Doctor, he looks pretty fucked. Like, he looks like he's already been embalmed, he's completely unconscious, he's not moving.
Yeah. Lobos goes, there is no way to reverse the process.
Mm-hmm.
Ian goes, well, do it anyway. Lobos goes, yeah, alright, I'll give it a go.
And then it turns out it works.
Cut back to Vicky. Shay Vicky is distributing weapons to kids.
Yeah. yeah, she's distributing the weapons, but is saying, we have to go back for Ian and Barbara.
Yeah, and Rebellious Teenager number 1 basically just goes, are you fucking tripping?
Like, bigger things at hand, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally thought that they'd kiss at this point, by the way.
Yeah,
but they didn't.
That never really happens, does it? Like, no. They do have an emotional connection.
Yeah,
like,
well, it seems as though...
leaving.
It seems very much to me as though they just want all of this trouble to end so that they can then spend the rest of their lives giving each other handjobs.
So, back to Vicky's age question that we've discussed in the past. So, these adolescents, they're what? 16,
16
17. 16, 17. So, yeah. Does that mean that she is of similar age?
Presumably, yeah.
Like, just obviously they're looking to jump into bed together.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They must be similar age.
They're like mega hormonal, and it appears as though there are no Xeron girls. There are only Xeron boys.
Yeah, shit. How are they repopulating themselves?
Well, they're not. I imagine that the morons are, like, they've separated them so that they don't have more Xerons. And instead, they just wait for the Xerons to come of age so that they can then enslave them. Which makes very little sense. But either way, there are no girls there.
And you think they'd rear them anyway, wouldn't you?
Like, also, then no one mentions women. Yeah. No one says, like, oh, they killed the women, or they brought the women to the other side of the planet, or they brought them to a different planet, or whatever.
Yeah, so
there's no mention of
so
them.
So what happens to the adolescent girls? It's just not taken into account at all, is
it? Totally glazed over that bit.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So, cut back to the morons. They're trying to drill their way into the TARDIS with no success whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. It's disgruntled henchman, a.k.a. Peugeot.
Yeah, and it just isn't working. We get a little cutscene of Barb still being poisoned with her rebel friend.
Yeah, Peugeot, by the way, he decides, like, oh, this is crazy. Like, why haven't you gotten into this TARDIS yet? I'm going to take all but one of you away from the TARDIS. So there is once again just one moron god in the TARDIS.
The key to the entire operation.
Yeah.
We'll leave one shitty guard.
Yeah. Cut back to Bob. Babs is picking up Frontal Gap and walks him through the smoke.
Yep.
My note here. Oh yeah, Babs is in the story.
I think it's just a brief reminder, 5-second reminder that she exists.
Yeah.
Back to the Doctor, as you said, lo and behold, he's fine.
Yeah.
Not only is he fine, but also, his brain has been functioning perfectly throughout the whole process.
Yeah.
In fact, it's been functioning better than normal.
Yeah, he says it's been working at the speed of a computer, but not just that. He's pulling a total John Spartan. You know, you've seen Demolition Man, right?
No.
Fucking hell. Okay. I don't care. You've had enough time to watch Demolition Man. Spoiler alert. You have seen it. Yeah, Sylvester Stallone.
Sandra Bullock, yeah.
Yeah. Sandra Bullock and Sly Stallone.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but great film.
Fantastic film.
What's his name in it?
John Spartan.
John Spartan.
Yeah. Great name.
So I love you, John Spartan.
Spartan! So
would
anyway.
You like to have intercourse with me? Great film.
But when he is frozen, or sorry, when he is unfrozen, he says he was aware the whole time, like he was awake for 60 years or something, and he remembers his wife beating against the ice block that he was sleeping inside of, basically.
Yeah.
The same shitting thing happened to the Doctor, because he was frozen and fully aware.
He was frozen for half an hour.
That's true.
He worked the whole thing out.
Yeah, that is true, but we can only assume at this point that all of the mannequined people in the museum are actually fully aware of what's going on.
Well, not necessarily, because the Doctor's only entered, like, the second phase. He hasn't been completely embalmed yet. Like, the others, they're presumably dead, right?
That is actually a good point.
Like, if you're encased, that's it. Game over, right?
That is a good point. Okay, yeah.
I should hope, anyway.
Yeah, we've got a soundbite, by the way, where the Doctor says, it's a pity, in the most fantastic manner. Soundbite.
It's a pity, isn't it? It's a pity! Mm-hmm.
Reference to what?
I can't remember. I can't remember what that refers to, but it was hilarious. So then, all of a sudden, Moron number 2, I presume, or whatever, and the two gods that he brought with him, it's Peugeot and two other morons, they sneak up behind him. So now Doc and Ian are recaptured.
Yeah. Which is fortuitous, because everybody else gets captured at almost exactly the same point, and they're all thrown into a room together.
That's true. Actually, wait, shit, we've got another soundbite we need to include. Sorry, dude. Really, really apologies. The ladies and gentlemen, the flab just shot me the most skeptical glance. This is, however, a fantastic soundbite because it is the scene that reaches the hitherto maximum level of density. The Doctor. Yeah?
Okay.
Soundbite.
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 Yes, and I'm not sure of that either, Chesterton. Have we? Have we? Or are we doing what we're allegedly intended to do? Now, what do you think?
Fantastic. Right, so yeah. Knock out Ian, recapture Doc, blam, blam, blam.
Yeah, Barb and the Rebel are captured, and they're all taken together and put in a room. Vicky is also captured.
How is Vicky captured? I don't remember this.
She must have been captured, because they're all in a room together.
Okay, so the next thing I've got is Lobos placing the ex-prisoner of Ian, that moron, under arrest. And by the way, what the hell did Ian do with him? Like, Ian captured a moron and then arrived at Lobo's office alone. You might assume that he knocked him out or something. But we don't know. He may just have gone, all right, now go about your business. Don't tell anyone, promise me. And then goes to Lobos, which would make sense. Like, it would make sense that he just left him there, because how else could Peugeot and the other two morons even know that he was there?
Telecommunications?
There is no telepathy in this episode.
Like, a phone?
Yeah. No dice, dude.
Text? I don't know.
So, anyway, the Peugeot, or no, whatever, who it is, the single guard guy, he holds Barb and her spandex boy toy prisoner for about 10 seconds before he is blasted to shit by Vicky's spandex boy toy.
Okay, but Vicky does get captured, so how does she get captured? She does get...
I think this is it. They get captured, but they're only captured... shit. All right, hang on. Yes, here we go. All right, so, sorry, just had to consult my notes. So, Barb and... Gap between his teeth, they exit the museum. They get captured by single guard. He gets blasted to shit by Vicky's spandex boy toy. And then someone else arrives, apparently kill Gap between his teeth, but we find out later on he was just knocked unconscious by the laser blast. And I think he actually does kill the other kid.
Right.
Because he doesn't wake up later on. Yeah. So now, Vapor Rub and Barbed Wire, they join the chaps in a makeshift detention cell, which is really just the room in the museum where they are to be embalmed.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense! Ladies and gentlemen, we had an argument about this before you press record. This makes no sense.
They do explain it, because obviously they're all in this cell with this machine. Ian's really pissed off with everything.
He vandalises it.
He vandalises the machine, breaks it to shit, and the Doc, I think it's the Doc, or is it Barb, that comments.
It's Doc.
I'm sure they have more than one of those.
Yeah, but wouldn't it make more sense? If you are a moron guard, would you not place your prisoners in a different room to the one where the one operating machine that is actually going to embalm them is located?
Well, and also, even if there is more than one, I'm sure it's very expensive equipment.
Yeah, so exactly.
You wouldn't want to leave Ian alone with it.
Yeah, like, exactly.
They've seen this.
Or at the very least, like, tie them up or something. Just tie them up. God, no wonder this revolution succeeds. Spoiler alert. These people are so disorganized.
But they come to the interesting question, while they're all sitting in the cells together, have they changed the future or not?
Yeah, and if they haven't, will the revolution change their future?
Exactly.
Yeah, this is Vicky coming up with these thoughts, by the way.
They've affected the revolution,
haven't
they?
That's true.
They put thoughts in the brains of the black-clad young men.
That's true. So now we cut to the revolution that lasts approximately 2 minutes, part of which is an actionless phone call. And it transpires, the kids aren't dead after all, or at least a gap between his teeth isn't dead because he just wakes up, so maybe they're just stun guns.
Yeah.
And we learn that the kids have wiped out the barracks. Like, they have literally slaughtered hundreds of conscripted moron soldiers. And they've stolen more weapons.
Yeah, well, they've got access to the entire armory.
Yeah.
Like, they're sorted.
Lobos, at this point, basically starts filling a briefcase with untraceable bearer bonds and says that he has a ship standing by.
He's pulling all the copper wiring out the wall. He's fucking gone. And
then the kids arrive to rescue the troop.
Yeah, and everyone's saved.
This is basically the end of the episode. They start dismantling the museum.
Yep.
Vicky clearly wants to smoke Tor's dong, but doesn't get a chance to. And then...
Yeah.
And then... Oh, no.
At least they kept it short. I mean, we get the edge of discretion all over again.
Oh, why?
It doesn't last two 25-minute excruciating episodes, at least. But it is essentially the same explanation. Because at this point, we're all wondering, well, what the fuck happened here?
Yeah, and
like,
the Doctor...
Why was there this time delay that caused all of this? Hmm. Like, what the fuck?
But you know what? I would have preferred a wibbly-wobbly explanation that made no sense, rather than the Doctor exiting the TARDIS, holding a defunct switch, and going like, have you ever walked into a room? You know when you walk into a room and you flick the light switch, and it takes a few seconds before the light goes on? Exactly the same thing happened here. We flicked the switch, but something was a little bit wibbly-wobbly in the whatever, and it took a while for the TARDIS to actually...
So why doesn't this happen all the time? If there's a switch that does this and it often has a little delay, why don't they constantly get this little time delay?
You know what? Why is there a switch in the first place?
Why does this need a switch? Surely this is like a core component of what a time machine does.
Exactly.
It's not like it's a switch you'd want to turn on and off. It's a bit like the oxygen supply to the TARDIS. You don't switch it on and off. It's just always on. Like... What does this machine do, after all? It time travels. There's a time travel component. You'd think it'd just be on. Unless there's an off button for the entire TARDIS. Okay. Maybe there is.
There probably is.
There probably,
key.
Probably is.
Done. Yeah. Anyway, we do get a quote-unquote real ending as well.
Not really. But we didn't explain that properly. Basically, there's a little switch.
Yeah. And...
Yeah. Well, I guess we did.
We did.
There isn't much to it.
The only thing I've written in my notes is...
You turn it on, there's like a delay.
Yeah. Like my only note about this is... And then they reenact the fucking ending of the goddamn End of Sodding Discretion. Oh. Because if you had to reenact the ending of any episode so far...
That'd be the one.
Surely it would be the End of Discretion. Nothing left you feeling more satisfied, left you with greater closure than the Edge of Discretion.
But everybody's perfectly happy with this.
Yeah,
I guess it has happened before.
I guess so, yeah. And the Doc gets a souvenir from the museum. It is a space and time visualizer.
What does that do?
We don't really know yet, but I'm assuming it's going to factor into the next episode, or probably henceforth. Mm-hmm. But Ian comes out of the TARDIS and goes, what's that huge contraption you've got in the TARDIS? And the Doctor suddenly turns into a complete douchebag and goes like, I don't need your permission to put things in my TARDIS, you bastard. And then he explains, it's a souvenir. It's a space and time visualizer. And it's something... It may actually have been the contraption that he was inspecting when he got caught by the rebels / morons or whatever.
That's why he wandered off in the first place.
Exactly. Okay. So that'll probably factor in later on. And
we'll take their word for that.
I've got a guess. I've written... I don't know. This isn't a spoiler alert because I genuinely have not watched beyond this point. But my guess is that he's going to use it to bring by back to 60s London.
Mm.
Because he says to Ian something like, oh, I'll show you. It'll be very important. I will show you what this thing can do. And presumably it'll like more accurately pinpoint where they land or something to that effect. I'm guessing anyway.
So it'll make the time machine actually useful.
Yeah.
They can go places they want to go.
Yeah. And then we get the worst goodbye wave ever between Vex Vapor Rub and Tor, whose dong shall remain unsmoked. They are standing
3 feet apart.
3 feet apart, and they're waving to each other as though Vicky is leaning out the window.
Titanic.
Yeah, it looks like she's leaning at the window of a departing train with a white hanky in her hand, waving to Tor's unsmoked dong. Going, I hope I see you sometime in the future. TARDIS dematerializes, and we get the little bit about the next episode,
which you'd think would be fantastic, but I'm told is not.
So I hear.
Daleks. So the Daleks have been tracking the troops' movements.
Yeah.
Yeah. And are now looking to, guess what? Exterminate them.
Yeah. They refer to the troop as their greatest enemies, by the way. The greatest enemies of the Daleks are, at this point, the Doctor, a weedy history teacher, a badass science teacher who doesn't know science, and a ridiculous little girl whom they may have mistaken for a slightly more attractive predecessor, Susie.
So this is the greatest fighting race in the universe. They've met the Doctor, what, twice at this point?
Yeah.
And he is their biggest enemy of all time.
Yeah, okay.
I would argue, like, even with what we've seen from just what we know so far, the Thal are a bigger enemy than the Doctor.
But it does make sense.
They've been fighting the Thal for like 1,000 years.
That's true. But you know what? Like, it makes no sense in 1964 or 5, but it makes sense in 2014.
Yes.
Because now.
It makes sense now.
Yeah, because the Doctor has probably travelled back in time to points in time before Hartnell arrived, right?
Yeah.
So these Daleks may actually have encountered the Doctor.
And we've had 50 years of the Doctor doing shit to Daleks.
Yeah, exactly.
When they say say he is our greatest enemy now, you're like, okay.
Yeah.
But, like, and at this
actually,
point...
Yeah, and we actually don't know at what point in time this is.
Hmm.
The only reference in terms of where it is in space is Xeron, or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in... Or Xeros. But in terms of time, this could be a way, way back.
Yeah.
Like, way, way back.
They might have met John Hurt.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they knew about John Hurt in 1965.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fantastic cliffhanger that we get for the next episode, anyway, is the Daleks have a time machine. I am super excited. I mean,
I would be excited, except I've been told it's not that great.
But those are the best ones.
Yeah, I know.
Those are the best ones. I've got to say me just thinking about it.
There are best reviews. Speaking of reviews, reviews!
Reviews. Do you want to go first? Dude, it's been a while. Go for it.
It's been a while, so I'm going to be quite rusty. I really enjoyed this episode. It was super well self-contained.
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense, which is great fun, always.
Yeah.
Like, there were lots of wibbly-wobbly explanations. I love wibbly-wobbly explanations. Mm-hmm. The Edge of Discretion ending was painful. Mm. I mean, it just... It was another one of those scenarios, and we've had this many times before on Who Back When, where you're thinking, this is building to something epic.
Yeah.
Like, there is going to be an explanation at the end of this that is going to blow my mind, and it's going to lead into the next 50 years of Doctor Who. It didn't do that. It was a broken switch again.
Mm.
But, having said that, I've kind of come to expect that. Kind of ending and that kind of explanation. I thought the battle lines were really well drawn. There was a lot of tension in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give this a fair mark because I had a really good time watching it 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I actually enjoyed my little catch-up. So I am going to give it 3.0.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice one. I'm giving this a higher mark than you.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, spoiler alert, here's my note. I enjoy this serial. And we're going to get into listener reviews in a little moment, and I haven't read them yet, but I have seen some of the scores, and they are much lower. Much lower.
Interesting.
I'm giving this a 3.3. Here's why I'm marking it down, first of all. I'm marking it down because why the shit is Vicky leading the revolution? So far in the show, they've basically redrafted Barbara's character to be the one who's actually kind of the alpha female. She was in the Aztecs, and like, she basically is the one who can take charge in Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Yeah.
In Dalek Invasion of Earth, she was the one who could suddenly come up with military strategies, and she could take the guns, and she could like lead troops and whatever.
Yeah.
But instead, in this case, and read into this however you wish, in this case, she just hides in the closet. And Vicky, who is a child, we know that she's a wunderkind, we've been told that she's a wunderkind, but she is a child, she is a fucking Nimrod. She now leads a revolution led by children who should have staged a revolution ages ago, and hacks a computer in a very silly manner. And there are lots of logical flaws in the story, so that's why I'm marking this down.
She does have great technical ability. We have seen that before.
Yeah, we have.
She may be, on a social level, a child, and she and does kind of sound like
a... You mean like on a biological level, a child?
Yeah. But she has displayed technological prowess.
That is true. Okay, so that's why I'm marking it down anyway, because there are logical flaws in this. There are some things that I would have maybe expected to come out differently, but doesn't matter.
Never
heard of the button. And obviously I'm marking this down for the Edge of Discretion reenactment, because, Jesus Christ, would have preferred a wibbly-wobbly explanation to that.
Mm-hmm.
Here's why I'm marking it up. It plays with time. Don't know if you've heard this one, but the last audiobook review that JD and I did, No More Lies, the main thing that I think both of us actually really enjoyed about it was that, spoiler alert, it wasn't just a time travel adventure in the sense that time travel is just used as an excuse to plonk the protagonist in a particular setting, mm-hmm. and then they have a local adventure. But instead, we now have time travel as a theme. Like, it has more of a science fiction and, like, a deeper science fiction value. It all revolves around, oh, they're jumping timelines, and then you catch up with themselves. It's all like Marty McFly, and it is Back to the Future 3, where Emmett Brown's gravestone equals the mannequins that they all of a sudden notice standing right next to them. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I'm marking this up. And I thought this was it was a romp. There were fantastic lines in it. There was a lot of action in this, which I gotta say, I enjoy that.
Yeah.
Fantastic fight scenes with
Ian's Roundhouse was wonderful.
Holy crap, Walker Texas Ranger.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Thus, I'm giving this a 3.3.
Wicked.
Metallic.
Now, let's see what our users thought.
Yeah. Users? Our listeners.
Well, I'm sure they are all users if they're listening to us.
Okay. Let's pause the recording here, read some listener reviews, and then read them out loud to you guys.
Cool.
So we just read the listener reviews. We've got some really good ones.
Yeah. People clearly didn't like it quite as much as we did.
Some did.
Yeah.
Some did.
I learned in that little phase that it's pretty much universally a hated episode, but
yeah.
I didn't hate it.
Yeah. Let's read them out in the order in which, as in chronological order.
This in which is they were received.
Exactly. Yeah. So please do not think that we are biased when we start off with fellow Who Back When co-host, JD.
You're the man.
Hey, JD.
Hey, JD.
Hello, hello. You can follow JD on Twitter, by the way. He is at Marius Kane.
That's Kane with a K.
Shall we do this one paragraph at a time, as per, well, the previous usual?
Tradition.
Yeah. Tradition.
Do it.
We fear change.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a Luddite by nature.
All right. Do you want to start?
Machine Breaker, yes. So JD says, Barbara and her team get into a really good time paradox due to the TARDIS jumping a time track. As the timelines converge, their current and future selves finally arrive, setting up what surely must be a brilliant next episode.
Which never materializes. The rest of the story just contains Vicky joining forces with three teenagers for the worst revolution this side of Les Miserables.
Les Miserables. The good. Episode 1 is Edge of Destruction level weird, in a good way, Flappy, and the freezing of time travellers and the mystery of the clothes changing.
But, Doctor, we have got our clothes on. I should hope so, dear boy. His entire blasé attitude over the changing of the clothes is actually one of the best Hartnell bits in a long time.
The just barely okay. Vicky's irritation index manages to get to an all-time low of 1.8 in this episode, because while she manages to intone the utter twaddle line, time, like space, although a dimension in itself, also has dimensions of its own, with about as much emotional range as a rotten potato, she does manage to be more intelligent than any of the non-regular cast.
The bad. The first death of a main character occurs in this episode, Barbara's cardigan. Rest in peace, comfortable knitwear, rest in peace.
The people of the show are so bloody stupid that the four time travellers, simply by landing, raise the IQ of the entire planet by at least 20 points.
The start of episode 2, after the amazing episode 1 ending, spends 5 minutes of pure exposition setting up the political structure on the planet. It's so mind-numbingly dull, it could actually have done with some zombie sound effects and maybe a bit of insect movement by Rosalind D. Winter.
Man,
liven it up.
I'd almost forgotten the zombie. Everything's a step up from the zombie. It's explained at the end of episode 4 that the reason they jumped the time track was a broken spring. Someone copied and pasted the Edge of Discretion's ending by mistake.
JD concludes, overall, what a waste of a great idea. Episode 1 sets up a brilliant mystery and has a unique premise, but then the rest is just drivel. He gives it 1.9.
You see, I think I give a lot of marks when we're going through giving marks to good ideas. Like, even if they're completely fucked, as they were in
this episode. I pointed out very clearly, I've raised the mark of this episode because of the time traveller and, you know, the logic premise.
I guess it's all about where you put the emphasis, isn't it?
Yeah, there you go.
Like, I wasn't expecting it to pan out well, I guess.
You've come to expect a certain level.
I've come to expect a certain level of springy breakiness. Anyway, thank you very much, JD.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to the next one. And the next audiobook.
They're pretty good, aren't they?
Big up.
Yeah, he's fantastically knowledgeable. He continues to impress me. Anyway, so, right, the next listener review comes from another long-time listener, long-time contributor, Kyle. Kyle is at Sinister Super Spy, that's super without any vowels. And he starts off, before going into his review, by saying, gentlemen, enjoy this shorter review. Well, Kyle, thank you very much.
And it is significantly shorter.
Yeah. That's what she said. And because of
this... But still not short. Sure.
She also said that. Yes, it's like you were in the room, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
I was watching.
You were holding the boom mic.
Yeah.
We will finally read out the full thing. Do you want to start this one?
Kyle says, after leaving the company of Richard the Lionheart, the Doctor and his companions become frozen in time. They waken from their slumber to discover that the TARDIS has landed on Xeros, a planetary museum that stood as a testament to the Moroks. The planet itself was once home to the simple yet peaceful Xerons, whose adult population were enslaved by the Moroks. Left behind were the children, now grown, to work in the museum. Exploring the museum, the TARDIS crew discover themselves, locked in some kind of long-term stasis chambers, permanently on display. The Doctor surmises that they have jumped a time track and are experiencing events at some point in their immediate future. They realise they must work to avoid this future reality by any means necessary.
What works? Number one, big ideas. This serial tries to tackle the notion of the dimensions of time. We are introduced to a seemingly routine open, only to discover much later that the strange quirks along the way are a result of the crew experiencing their own future as spectators. They can see it, but are unable to interact with it. The lead-up was subtle, and it isn't until Vicky tries to touch an object that pieces begin to fall into place. The attention to detail, no footprints, guards oblivious to a sneeze, were nicely handled.
And the lack of echo.
Yeah, nice.
Love the lack of echo. Yeah. Number two, Vicky, warrior princess. How refreshing was it for the writer to give Vicky something useful to do for a change? She makes fruitful contact with the Xerons, she rewires a security access station and gains entrance to the armory, and effectively becomes the de facto saviour of the TARDIS crew by assisting in igniting the Xeron revolution. Vicky is the hero of the story.
Yeah, you know what? I disagree with you, Carl. Sorry to say it. I get that this works within this story, but I disapprove.
Well, like, I think the fact she manages to change the machine so amazingly is the hub of why they do.
Yeah, sure. I don't disagree that she is the hero of this story, but I disagree with the fact that they chose. I disapprove of the fact that they chose her to be the hero of the story. Anyway, Carl goes on. What doesn't work? To be honest, episodes 2 to 4. The first episode set up an amazing gauntlet for the crew to run through. Unfortunately, we never return to the complex notion of free will versus determinism suggested by their discovered possible future.
Again, I think we do return to it. It's just very confused.
Yeah.
While I enjoyed this serial, it's too bad that the focus droned on to the boring and predictable conflict between the Moroks and the Xerons. The humour, though there was not nearly enough of it, was great.
And the Doctor, hiding inside the Dalek, saying, "I am the Master," gave me chills for a moment. Nice one.
Yeah, if that had been expanded on, and John Sim had turned up, it'd been great.
Yeah.
The Space Museum is, for the most part, good fun. It is, at times, clever. It highlights the best of each character. The Doctor outsmarting the bad guy. Ian single-handedly defeating a host of soldiers. Barbara exemplifying what a strong woman is, and is capable of. And Vicky, the consummate outsider, finding her groove. But it falls a bit short of the mark by not following through in its initial premise. An issue common with a lot of early Who.
He concludes, "For me, the serial gets a 3.3. That's a very good mark.
I think that's a fair mark.
Yeah, at least that's
I'd say it's about 0.3 too high, but, you know, do I know?
Whatever.
Yeah, what do I know?
I completely agree with your mark. Yeah. Kyle, thank you very much for another spiffing review.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got... You know what? This one came completely out of the blue.
I'd have never expected.
Gina Guerrero. Mm. Hello, Gina!
Hey, Gina.
Gina is fantastic. Oh. And such a super-duper Whovian. Did you read the review she wrote of Who Back When itself?
Right on the money.
She's fantastic! What an awesome thing to do, to write a review. People, please follow Gina's example and write reviews of us.
Only good ones, though.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
People who are not Gina, you can follow Gina on Twitter. She is... at Gina Guerrero 1. And she says, "Firstly, I would like to call this story The Return of Ian, Badass in a Turtleneck. But we'll get to that. I honestly felt that this is the first story that has dealt with both time travel and alien planets. This was disheartening because the story was okay. I can say there were moments that I absolutely loved. It was interesting to see how the TARDIS crew tried to change their futures after witnessing themselves as museum exhibits and how each reacted to the time track prediction. I found it fascinating that the Doctor is not okay with changing the future in any other situation unless it is his own."
Ian was back in a big way, ranging from irritable and doctorish with Barbara and Vicky, and determined and heroic while trying to save the Doctor. I think Barbara and Vicky switched roles, because Barbara's cardigan was more useful than she was in the story. On the other hand, Vapor Rub is put to good use here, rising above the title of Susan Clone, showing that she does have some intelligence. Even though William Hartnell was obviously on holiday for the third episode, I enjoyed his almost gleeful performance. The first episode was amazing with a tension-filled cliffhanger, but after that, the remaining three episodes did not live up to the promise of the first, a common theme.
She goes on, stray observations. The doctor somehow besting a guard, shouting, exterminate! And emerging from his hiding place in a Dalek made me laugh out loud. Other favourite moments include the interrogation scene between Governor Lobos and the doctor, Vicky tricking the security system in the armory, and Ian's general stone-cold badassness. The characters, the Moroks and the Xerons, were semi-interesting, mostly due to poor acting and the dialogue being mostly exposition. While the governor, as you guys would say, shit over his lines, and seemed to me to flip-flop from overacting to disinterest. This story actually has some depth, the message being some evil must be fought with violence.
Even though the Doctor gets the better half of his battle of wits with the Governor, it is only when Ian marches in with a gun that the Doctor is revived and freed. Lastly, when the Doctor began to explain how lights work and why the TARDIS skipped time, I was overcome with edge of death crushing flashbacks. The laziness in the writing is obvious, with Barbara experiencing no long-term effects from the Zafragas, and the final battle in which the rebels run around, shoot ray guns, and uneventfully defeat their oppressors and take back their planet is similarly dull. So my rating is a 3.6 for a great first episode, bringing Ian back to his former glory and actually giving Vicky something to do. Love you guys, mucho!
4 exclamation marks, she even adds twixt asterisks. Figured it was time you guys earned an extra exclamation point.
Sweet.
I couldn't agree with you more
there,
Gina.
If we keep going for a few more years, maybe we'll be up to a paragraph.
That's a fantastic review. Seriously, yeah. Gina, thank you so much for sending that in.
Thank you.
She brings one thing up that we really did not even touch upon, and that is the Zafragas.
Yeah.
That is entirely inconsequential.
Yeah. But the Zafragas, I guess we don't know what its properties are.
Well, it was meant to paralyze them, but no one is paralyzed by it.
Is it not meant to kill them?
No, Lobos, head moron, says, no, it paralyzes everything. Like, they'll be paralyzed within a few minutes or something, and then we can go in and probably undress them and redress them.
Right, okay. But I wonder how long paralysis takes. Maybe it's slow acting.
Gap between his teeth, he was kind of paralyzed.
Yeah.
But not Bob.
Yeah.
Because Babs is badass.
Mm.
Anyway, Gina.
Strength of character.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Awesome. Awesome review. 3.6 there. Mm. Okay, so we're oscillating a little bit here. Next up, we've got Davis of the Davis Principle fame.
And I'm just remembering the mark he gave it.
Wow.
Yeah. But we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Davis says, this episode is by far the best episode so far. Hartnell clearly loves this as well. In fact, let's celebrate by listing my favourite moments of this episode involving the Doc. It's just putting two and two together to make three, episode one. I'd never seen anything like it in all my years of travelling all my life, episode one. The Doctor in a Dalek, episode two. The Doctor and the Thought TV thingy, episode two.
Davis goes on. Anyways, this episode was awesome. It actually played with the idea of time travel, and I thought that was done really well. Also, Ian went darker than usual, showing a new side of him. Finally, Vicky is constantly getting Susaned by the Doc, so she learns to be quiet. Such an improvement. Then she leads a revolution. Oh, well.
I give this serial a 4.7, because it was hilarious and really well done. I only mark off because of the convoluted armory lock, which made no sense when Vicky fixed it. Still, I love this story and have high hopes for the upcoming Dalek story.
Yeah, nice one. Nice, seriously, Davis, nice one. The whole Hartnell bit in the beginning, very nicely done.
And he clearly is loving it, Hartnell, as you said, like in the
yeah,
inside
exactly.
The Dalek.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's you can see the enjoyment
the
in his face. Yeah. Oh my god, that is fantastic. Gotta say though, Davis, 4.7.
Mm.
Wow. I think we may have pointed this out before, but you've got a really big heart.
Yeah.
Nice one. Thank you so much. Actually, Davis tweeted when he was halfway through this serial. He tweeted, and I quote, halfway through the Space Museum, this is rapidly becoming my favorite story. And a smiley face. So it apparently came to fruition. He finished it. Still loved it. Well done.
You know, I only got really disappointed with it in the back end of episode 4. Gotta say. Like, I didn't agree with earlier reviews that disparaged episode 2 and 3. I thought it was building well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It only fell apart at the last moment. It did fall apart, so you've got to take a lot off for that. But...
Absolutely.
But I'm really pleased to hear somebody actually enjoying this episode, which is great.
People who are not Davis, follow Davis on Twitter. He is at ShrubThe. That's it in terms of mini reviews, but we did get an email from another listener. Evan, thank you very much for writing in to us.
And it's always great to hear from someone new.
Yeah.
Not that we don't love the old gang. thank you so much, Evan, for listening. And, yeah, let's read it.
Evan says, the Space Museum is commonly panned. I haven't seen it. I wouldn't know. However, there is a special feature on the DVD called Defending the Museum, in which Doctor Who writer Rob Sherman explains why he thinks it's a postmodern genius, and you guys should decide for yourselves. And what Evan has done here is he has sent a link to us, a YouTube link, where you can find the whole interview with Sherman. And I'm going to post this on the website. So if you go to whobagwhen.com, you can watch the interview for yourself.
It's got to be said, it's never a good sign when somebody has to defend their own...
No, that's true.
...their own work. Like, what's the guy who writes Dexter trying to defend the final episode? That was quite funny. I only read it.
No, I haven't read it, but Jesus Christ.
Oh. Jesus Christ. There's no defense of that.
No, I mean, such a great series, then ultimately shat upon.
Yeah, there isn't a defense of that.
Ugh, no, not at all. Yeah, anyway, seriously, yeah. check out the video. It's on the site. Evan, thank you so much for pointing us in that direction. I hadn't seen that before.
No, me neither.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I think we did it.
I think we did it. I can't believe it. It's finally happened. But
I'm so pleased that we're back on these, dude.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back on main series Who.
We've got the band back together.
Yeah.
We're back on the black and white.
We're rocking out. And, you know, I thought I really enjoyed reviewing the Space Museum. Like, I think it was a lovely one to come back on. And I'm looking forward to what is meant to be a terrible next episode.
But it is a Dalek one. I love the Daleks. It is going to be a good one regardless.
I don't see how you can go wrong with the Dalek, but
I don't know.
I'm interested to find out.
I believe it was JD who told me off the record that it was Daleks trying to do comedy.
Mm.
Yeah, I can't remember if that referred to this episode or a different one.
This episode is Daleks doing comedy.
Either way, it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, join us next time for The Chase. Well, I say next time. Next time we're going to get into audiobook land again. JD and I are reviewing Human Resources. And then after that, we are doing...
The Chase.
The Chase.
Which is going to be bonkers.
So with that, you should follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I did actually tweet, like, a week ago.
Yeah, you did. Yes.
It was just to apologize.
And you are at...
One Too Many Mornings.
Yes, you are. And I am at Ponkin. So check us out on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen. Subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes, please. If you've listened this far, then clearly you must have enjoyed it. Why don't you prove it to the world? Log on to iTunes and give us 5 stars.
I would review it, but I think that'd be insider trading.
Yeah, I haven't reviewed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, on general principle, I haven't.
I haven't uttered these immortal words in a long time, but I shall catch you on the flap side.
Yes, you shall! Oh, I was waiting for it! Shamalama ding dong, people. Ciao.
Back when.